Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, Pope Benedict remembers the world sick this Wednesday, and Vatican City-State celebrates its 80th birthday. We hear how the world's smallest city-state came into its own back in 1929. Pope Benedict XVI greeted thousands of pilgrims on an overcast Wednesday here in the Vatican for the customary weekly general audience, urging the faithful to reach out to the weakest and most vulnerable members of society, the sick. His appeal for the respect of the sanctity of human life in all its phases comes as the Church celebrates the 17th World Day for the Sick. The Pope said he would be praying for the world sick in a special Mass in St. Peter's Wednesday and would be meeting with many of them afterwards. Charles Collins tells us more.
Pope Benedict remarked on the World Day of the Sick during his weekly general audience. Speaking on the Feast of Our Lady of Lourdes, the Holy Father said the Holy Virgin supports those who carry the daily cross of suffering in union with Christ. The Pope was speaking to over 8,000 people in the Paul VI Audience Hall. Last week, he concluded his special catechesis on St. Paul. This week, he returned to the great Christian writers of the Church, this time speaking about John Climacus.
John Climacus, whose name means ladder, was born around 575 and wrote an outstanding tract near Mount Sinai on the spiritual journey leading from renunciation of the world to perfection in love. The journey takes place in three stages. The first involves detachment from worldly goods in order to return to a state of gospel innocence and enter into a deeper communion with God. In the second phase, the soul engages in a spiritual battle with the passions by cultivating virtues corresponding to each. When purified, these passions can show us the way to God through self-denial and grace. In the third phase, John emphasizes the importance of discernment. We must examine every aspect of our behavior in order to ascertain our deepest motivations and reawaken a sense of the heart.
Pope Benedict says this leads to the tranquility of the soul, which prepares us to probe the depths of the divine mysteries.
The last rung of the ladder consists in faith, hope, and charity. John's account of charity includes eros, or human love, which points towards the nuptial union of the soul with God. May John's spiritual ladder remind all of us who share in the death and the resurrection of Christ through baptism that we are called to continual conversion and purification with the help of the Holy Spirit.
At the end of the audience, the Pope greeted bishops who have come to Rome for meetings sponsored by the San Egidio and Focolare movements. He told them he was happy they were becoming familiar with the works of the movements and hoped they would be able to carry the fruits of these days of prayer and reflection back to their homes.
The Vatican released the Pope's message for the World Day for the Sick last Saturday. You can find it on our Vatican Radio website. That's vaticanradio.org or on the Holy See's official webpage at www.vatican.va. But let's take a moment now to hear some of the highlights of the Holy Father's message. Charles Collins has this report.
The World Day of the Sick falls each year on February 11th, the Feast of Our Lady of Lourdes. The Pope writes that this year's focus is on children. He speaks about the children suffering debilitating illnesses, many of which are incurable. He also draws attention to those injured in the world's conflicts and wars, as well as those suffering from hunger and deprivation due to migration. Pope Benedict says the Christian community cannot be indifferent in the face of such terrible situations and has the urgent duty to help. He also urges the local church to help families of sick children who are often in great need. He gives the example of a local Roman charity which provides a place to stay for the families of those being treated in the local children's hospital. He says the treatment of sick children is an eloquent example of treasuring the value of human life, especially of those who are weak and absolutely dependent on others. He says it's necessary to affirm the absolute and supreme dignity of every human being and proclaim the goodness of the gift of human life, even when that life is weak and shrouded in the mystery of suffering. I'm Charles Collins.
This year's message for the World Day of the Sick focuses on the well-being of children. We asked the head of the Vatican's Council for Healthcare, Cardinal Lozano Barragan, why children?
Because the child are the weak part of the society, especially the poorest. Many of them are sick, and we must take all our attention in order to heal them. Many times they are abandoned by the society, also by the governments, and there we find them in the streets, outside of the streets, without any care. And we must put a special care of them because they are beloved of Christ.
While that focus is on the physical state of children, mostly in third world nations, what to say then about children in industrialized countries where illness can be of a different kind? Spiritual malaise.
Yes, it is a very actual illness. The illness of sadness, of abandon, of many children that are in his own houses without any attention of their parents because they are separated by the divorce, by the break of the family, or simple because the parents are always in work and they have no time to take care of the children. Therefore, it is the frustration and the depression for them. And there are also the very bad examples. A child had seen about 15,000 hours in television, and in the television they have more or less to 18,000 murders in the different shows of television. And this is not a very good school for them.
Cardinal Lozano Barragan is head of the Vatican's Council for Healthcare. Well, the Pope's message came as heated controversy raged all across the country here in Italy over the right to life or to death of a young woman who had been living in a vegetative state for the past 17 years. 38-year-old Eluana Englaro died Monday night, 4 days after doctors at an Italian clinic removed her feeding and hydration tubes. In a case that has dramatically divided Italian public opinion, in much the same way as the Terry Schiavo case divided the American public a few years back, an Italian court gave the family of Eluana the green light to remove the feeding tubes which had kept her alive. Vatican and church leaders spoke out strongly against the measure, and right-to-life groups across Italy and Europe gathered for prayer meetings and demonstrations calling for Eluana's right to life, however little of it there might be. One of the groups lobbying on behalf of coma victims is the British-based Lineker Center, a Catholic think tank for healthcare ethics. Emer McCarthy spoke to the director of the center, Dr. Helen Watts.
Father Federico Lombardi, the Vatican spokesman, said that the passing of Eluana Englaro has cast a shadow, really, around the whole debate that is currently ongoing in Italy and that was provoked by the case of Eluana Englaro on the right to life. But unfortunately, many people call it the right to die. Why has modern society, particularly in the Western world, become so very confused over something that should be so simple?
I think what we've forgotten is to value the presence of a human being. So the value of a human being can never be reduced to what that human being can do. The value of a human being is about what they are, you know, a living human individual who is a member of the human family.
Now, Helen, A lot of the people who supported Elwana's father's petition to have feeding and hydration stopped, and to quote Beppe Englaro, Elwana's father, to accompany her to death, as being the fact that this permanent vegetative state that Elwana was in was more or less a living death. Can we really define coma as a living death?
No, I don't think we can. Technically, this was different from coma in that Elwana was able to sleep and wake, whereas coma is a sleeping state. But in any case, I think we have to see a person as alive while that person's body is alive. Life is a bodily state, and if a person is still a living bodily whole, if a person is still able to engage in bodily activities, even if that person is still asleep, that person must be respected as a human being.
Because a lot of people would argue, and I am playing the devil's advocate here, a lot of people would argue that if someone is not able to feed and hydrate themselves, then they would die anyhow, and it's just the advances of modern science that keep them alive, and it's not really God's will in the first place. How do we therefore confront this argument?
Many people who are severely disabled would die if no one fed them, but that cannot be a reason to abandon them. Now, of course, we have to distinguish between methods of life support, which are very invasive, very expensive, very difficult, and very simple forms of basic care, such as tube feeding a person who is unable to feed him or herself. Now, I think if the motive is to make someone die, that is always very seriously wrong. And even if the motive is not to make someone die, you still have to ask, is that person being neglected or are that person's basic needs being met?
Elwana was in a permanent vegetative state. At what point, for people in these conditions, at what point do you say it is right to feed and hydrate them? And at what point can doctors ethically and morally say it is not right?
Well, it's never right to stop feeding a person with the motive of making that person die. That is a kind of euthanasia. It's euthanasia by omission. So if that is the reason that you're stopping feeding, that is always morally wrong. Now, there are some rare situations where you can stop feeding a patient because they are very close to death and they can no longer absorb the food. So food feeding would just cause that person more problems. But this is not the case of Elwana. Elwana was not dying. She could benefit from feeding and she should have been fed. And she certainly should not have had feeding withdrawn with the aim of making her die.
And a warm thanks there to the director of the Lineker Centre in Britain, Dr. Helen Watt. February 11th, 1929, the day that Vatican City became the world's smallest state. It was on that chilly winter day that fascist leader Benito Mussolini and Cardinal Pietro Gasparri signed the Lateran Treaties, providing for the mutual recognition of what was then the Kingdom of Italy and the Vatican City.
Well, the Lateran agreements recognize the independence and sovereignty of the Holy See and the creation of the Vatican City State. A second pact under the Accords defined the civil and religious relations between the government and the Church in Italy. And a third convention provided the Holy See compensation for papal states seized in the mid-1800s by the newly united Kingdom of Italy. The term Holy See, meanwhile, refers to the supreme authority of the Church, the Pope. It's the central government of the Catholic Church, and it is the Holy See which sends and receives diplomatic representatives to and from other states. Today, the Holy See maintains full diplomatic relations with more than 170 nations. All this is thanks largely to the Lateran Pacts. But what exactly did those treaties mean in terms of the Pope's temporal powers? Well, to help answer that question and more, I'm joined today by Vatican historian and former archivist Monsignor Charles Burns. Hello, Monsignor Burns.
Good morning. Good morning.
Now, take us back a moment to 1929. What exactly brought about this historic accord between Italy and the Vatican City-State?
The pact that was signed in 1929 really was the culmination of a long, long history. History concerning the papacy, history concerning the Italian peninsula. Because for 1,000 years, the Pope had enjoyed temporal sovereignty over the whole of central Italy. This then became a cause of contention when the other Italian states, the Kingdom of Naples, Tuscany, all these other states, small states, decided to go for unification in order to create the Kingdom of Italy. Now, from 1860 onwards, they began to occupy part of the papal territory, and then in 1870, on the 20th of September, the troops actually occupied the city of Rome. Pius IX took refuge inside the Vatican and never went out from it from then onwards. Neither did his successors, Leo XIII, Pius X, Benedict XV, because they felt that their sovereign rights had been violated very, very severely by this usurpation of their state.
Was there any time in that period where the popes felt their lives were at risk?
I don't think they felt their lives were at risk, but they had to tread very carefully. But so also had the Italian government, because effectively in occupying Rome in 1870, they breached an international agreement with France. The agreement was that they would not occupy the papal territory if the French garrison had to withdraw to France during the Franco-Prussian War, when the French soldiers were called back. That was the moment that the House of Savoy chose to just march straight into Rome. So they had actually breached an international agreement in doing this. That made their position weak internationally.
So from the 1870s up to 1929, what happened during that period?
From 1870 till 1929, the whole thing was, how are we going to solve the Roman question? It was something that had to find a solution. Various proposals were put forward, but eventually Pius XI, he was determined that he would solve this question. The question, of course, was the question of territory. Originally, it was proposed that the Holy See would receive sovereign territory extending out as far as the Mediterranean. Then that was reduced. At one stage, it was going to be from the present Vatican City, right across the city of Rome, to Villa Pamphili, taking in the whole of Villa Pamphili and the area between that and St. Peter's, which isn't vast territory, but it's certainly much more than we have today. Now, in order that that could not be an obstacle in the negotiations, Pius XI gave up that idea of Villa Pamphili. And indeed, right up until the very night before the signing, there was a problem over a small strip of land that ran up the side of the Holy Office. The Pope gave up that too, in order to get the signatures on this essential step to stop the impasse between the Holy See and Italy. The Duce, Mussolini, he realised that the Pope couldn't be expected to do any more. The Pope had gone beyond all the limits that most people thought he would have to abide by. The Pope had shown he had no intention whatsoever to have territorial aggrandisement. But he did have to have that handkerchief of sovereign territory that wasn't just spiritual. It had to be internationally recognized territory and sovereignty over it.
So was it then, can we date it back to 1929, when the Holy See first established diplomatic relations then with another country, which I would assume would have been Italy.
No, the diplomatic relations of the Holy See with other countries isn't a concession granted by Italy. Diplomatic relations of the Holy See go right back, I mean permanent diplomatic relations, go right back to the end of the 15th century. And during the 16th century, we really get the build-up of a diplomatic corps, basically Europe. In the 19th century, especially with the independence of the countries in Latin America, they all sought recognition, their national recognition from the Holy See by establishing diplomatic relations. The result is we begin then, from then onwards, to find an expansion in diplomatic relations long before 1929. Immediately after the First World War, with the creation of the new Europe, the remapping of Europe, countries like Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, Czechoslovakia, the new Austria, Yugoslavia, and all these countries, they all established diplomatic relations with the Vatican. It's only later, I mean, 10 years later maybe, that we find Italy establishing diplomatic relations with the Vatican, because the question had been solved. Italy had recognized the territorial sovereignty of the Pope. Vatican City was not a dépendance of the Kingdom of Italy. It was sovereign, autonomous territory.
I know we don't really have time to get into it, but the Lateran Pacts did cover a lot of other issues, like the Pope had to submit candidates for bishop and archbishop to the Italian government, for example.
Yes.
It also Italy also agreed to adapt laws on marriage and divorce to those of the Catholic Church.
Yes. Well, now, you see, there were two things were signed on that 11th of February. One was the actual Lateran Pact, establishing acknowledging the sovereignty of the Vatican. The other was the Concordat between the Holy See and the Italian government. Now, the Holy See acts when a national hierarchy is maybe not in a position to establish something between itself and a government. The Holy See, because of its sovereign status, then, on behalf of a national hierarchy, obtains from that government an international agreement on how the Church can function within the territory of that nation. It's a complicated question, but in some cases it has saved the life of the Church in the country involved. Here in Italy, the question was different. The question basically turned around things like the schools, that the Pope did not want the fascist government to have complete control over education. He also fought for the sacrament of marriage, etc. That was one of the most important things at that time in that concordat with Italy. That concordat has been revised because times have moved on, things have changed. There were lots of things which the Church in Italy recognized were now obsolete, and it was better to renegotiate the concordat. And that was done at the time of Craxi and Cardinal Casaroli.
Okay, well, I see we've run out of time, although we've condensed history into just a few moments. Thank you very much to Monsignor Charles Burns, a Vatican historian and former archivist here in the Vatican. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Very interesting.
Taking a look back at history.
Well, moving out of that studio, we return to this one, where we hear Philippa Hitchin speaking to the governor of Vatican City State, Cardinal Giovanni Laiolo. She put a thorny question to him.
Cardinal Giovanni Laiolo, we're here marking this 80th anniversary of the foundation of Vatican City State, and there are those today who question the need for this temporal power, this temporal authority. How can we justify today the existence of this sovereign state for the exercise of spiritual authority over the world's Catholics?
The whole purpose of the sovereign state of the Vatican City is to safeguard the Pope from political interference or pressure as he leads the Church and carries out his ministry of the Gospel, which is at the service not just of Catholics, but for all of humanity. The Vicar of Christ must be independent and free to act without being called to account by any earthly authority, but simply by God. The history of Europe, especially, demonstrates how often in past centuries, and even in the 20th century, governments or regimes have tried to limit the freedom of the Pope in carrying out his mission. Even today, there are many politicians who would prefer the Pope to remain silent on those moral issues that they don't agree with. Vatican City-State, within his tiny territory, guarantees the Pope full independence from any external political influence.
It's true to say that today there is still an undoubted fascination with what is often seen as this very mysterious world behind the walls of Vatican City. Are you keen to maintain that image, or are these 80th anniversary celebrations and perhaps your new website ways of modernizing and changing this image somehow?
In my view, this is a myth without any basis on reality. If people are looking for information, all they need to do is look at the documentation which is freely available to everyone, such as the laws and regulations governing the Holy See and the Vatican City-State. Above all else, these are the instruments that can help people understand what is behind the Vatican walls. And they also offer clarification about many statements and actions that are taken by the Holy See. Apart from that, Vatican Radio gives a vast amount of information about what is going on in the Vatican today. And I am delighted to be able to thank all those involved for this important service, which is available in some 39 languages. Then there is the Osservatore Romano, which is available in 6 different language weekly editions, as well as the daily Italian edition. You have the Holy See website, www.vatican.va, and the Vatican City State, www.vaticanstate.va. And just recently, the new YouTube site has been launched. Beyond all that, if someone is looking for information that is not available through any of these means, then he or she can always contact the press office or the various offices of the Holy See. I think the celebrations of this 80th anniversary of Vatican City-State are another opportunity to discover this mysterious world, which is in fact the very straightforward and transparent world of the Vatican.
Cardinal Giovanni Laiolo is the governor of Vatican City-State. That concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.